From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Alex Cooper was 15, she came out to her parents. Her family's Mormon, and the news didn't go over well. They kicked her out at first, and eventually they sent her to St. George to live with a family who figured they could use the same kinds of tactics on Alex they used on juvenile delinquents to cure her homosexuality. What they ended up doing was physically and psychologically abusing her. We're talking about this story today. There's a new book about Alex's experience. Part of the story is about the struggle of religious parents to deal with their gay children. It's also about how these discredited concepts of conversion therapy seem to persist somehow. And then there's a legal question in Alex's story, too. If you're gay but a minor, what are your rights in your own home? Join us after the news. This week in Video West, see another in our series with Herta Saunders. Herta has agreed to share her journey with us. She's been diagnosed with a form of progressive dementia. And when the time is right, and everyone hopes that's years away, but when the time is right, Herta is going to take her own life. So she's thinking a lot about the criteria for a life worth living. Go see the film at videowest.org. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot going on in Alex Cooper's book. First, just the drama in the story at the heart of it all. When she was 15, Alex came out to her parents, who are conservative Mormons and who didn't take it very well. Her family lived in California, and they sent Alex away to St. George to what they thought was a residential treatment center that would, in effect, scare her straight with tough love. What really happened, though, is she ended up in a house of a family who were in her grandparents' ward and who physically and psychologically abused her. So there's that. But the book also illustrates how these so-called gay conversion therapies, despite having been widely discredited, haven't actually gone away. They've just gone underground. And one of the reasons is the religious culture and doctrine, in this case, Mormon culture and doctrine, that's still unsettled on LGBT issues. There's also an interesting legal case in here, too. There's a moment in the story where Alex's lawyer asks her kind of an extraordinary question for a minor. What is it, Alex, you want? And that's an important question because the state of Utah argued in this case a minor doesn't have the same constitutional protections as adults. But Alex wanted to go back home. She just didn't want her parents to try and change her. The book is called Saving Alex, and today in the program we're talking about it with Joanna Brooks, who is a scholar of American culture and religion. She's Associate Vice President of Faculty Advancement and a professor of English at San Diego State University. She's a frequent contributor to the blogs Religious Dispatches and Feminist Mormon Housewives. She's the author or editor of some 9 books, including a collection of essays called Mormon Feminism. And she co-authored Saving Alex with Alex Cooper, and Joanna Brooks is joining us today from a studio in La Mesa, California. And Joanna Brooks, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Great to be here.
Well, when did you come to know Alex's story, and what is it that interested you about it? I mean, beyond the just basic drama, I mean, did it contain a larger theme that you were particularly interested in?
So about almost 3.5 years ago now, I was contacted by members of the legal team who had worked with Alex during her transit out of captivity and into her independence. And they wanted to help Alex tell her story. Alex wanted to tell her story. She was about to turn 18 and had sort of independent legal footing under herself, and they felt it was a good time. And I was honored they reached out to me, and they said they did it because, you know, neither they nor Alex wanted Mormon people caricatured. You know, Alex's story is very difficult, as we'll explore together, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They didn't want it to end up being just another, you know, made for lifetime, sensationalized horror story.
Yeah.
They wanted it really to reflect honestly the struggles of Alex's parents, her family, the people she was raised by, and the Mormon community as a whole in a human way. And that deeply appealed to me My work at the time, especially in just coming off the 2012 election season, had been, you know, deeply engaging public perceptions of Mormons and, you know, trying to hold Mormon people accountable in the public eye as any other citizens, but also to demand from the media better representations of Mormons. So I was honored to have this opportunity to work with Alex and was so glad she wanted to approach her story in such a forthright way.
Well, there's a kind of a conspicuous absence in that she's not talking with us. And I don't know how much we can say about that.
But
I mean, this has been difficult for her. I think you mentioned in some way talking about the story, sort of reliving some of this is sort of traumatized or re-traumatized her in some ways. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Alex has done, we're about a month out from the book release now, and Alex has done a fair share of media, and it is very difficult. She's effectively, you know, I describe her as a torture survivor. She might refer to herself as an abuse survivor. Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of trauma she carries. And so, yes, speaking her truth in public. And remember, she's 21,
yeah.
Right? So she's not, she's still young.
Yeah.
And so it has been very draining. When we were writing the book, we could work together for about an hour and 15 minutes at a time. Then we'd need to take a break.
Wow.
So, yeah, she's not doing media right now, but she's excited to stand by your story. She has some events planned later in the spring. She's just come off some media, so she needs to take a little break.
Got it. All right. Let me ask you, one of the things you were saying is that Alex and you didn't want Mormon caricatures. But I wonder in some ways, is this a story that is kind of an aberration, that her family freaked out, sent her to this residential treatment center in St. George? Or is it typical, do you think?
I would call it an extreme manifestation of very common Mormon attitudes and beliefs. I don't think it's aberrant. I think it's extreme. The idea that gay people, as they are made by their creator, are not fully entitled to all the blessings God has to offer is not even close to being gone from Mormonism.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as that remains in place, the pressure to change or expend or purge essential parts of one's being as a gay person remains.
I was surprised by the role of St. George. I'm not sure I guess I've always heard about it as a place for these residential treatment centers. But I guess it's kind of a booming industry there. There's a lot of it going on there in St. George, it seems, or at least that's reflected in the book.
Right. So Alex came to St. George sort of through a family connection. But you're correct, Doug, that St. George is home to a large number of residential treatment centers, and even wilderness programs that operate in southern Utah, some of which I should say people struggling with addiction have reported to me finding very helpful, and others of which have been, you know, subject to investigations. There have been studies by public health workers and social scientists about the impacts of the kinds of, quote, treatments offered in residential treatment centers where children, you know, where underage young people are removed from their family contexts and stripped of all sort of markers of their personal identity so that they can be reformed through boot camp type techniques. There, you know, the scientific literature is that the outcomes of these programs are not good. They do not produce improved mental health. In fact, there is evidence they produce poorer mental health outcomes. So nonetheless, this tough love way of doing things, this notion you can send your child to a place, has purchase within LDS culture. It has purchase for desperate parents in the country at large, and St. George supports several residential treatment centers and programs.
I guess the sort of religious element of this, I think, is kind of interesting. You've talked about there being this long, quiet tradition in Mormonism of sending, you know, wayward children away, which is, it's not just a Mormon thing. I mean, you know, there's the whole Magdalene Laundry thing with Catholics who sent,
right,
you know, pregnant teenagers away to to have these babies and give them up for adoption. So I'm guessing there's a deep tradition going on here, but there is an interesting religious component here, it seems like.
I think so. And, you know, as I was helping Alex tell her story and drawing on my own knowledge of LDS culture, my own experiences, you know, I recall instances growing up where it was just sort of common practice if a young woman became pregnant, she might disappear from your ward for a year and go live with, quote, family in Arizona or someone, you know, someone in the Book of Mormon belt would take her in another place and she'd have the baby and come back. No one would say a word about it. And I, you know, I even remember the pineapple farms in Hawaii, right? Where, you know, if you're laughing, do you remember them too?
Okay,
so it's not just me.
No.
So, you know, wayward, errant young people would be sent to work for a summer. And, you know, there's a long, I think, American tradition of sending the city kid to the farm for the summer to get them straightened out and in touch with the land. But, you know, when you put it in a religious community in terms of issues of shame and managing misbehavior and thinking about what manages misbehavior, how to preserve the reputation of the family or even just the child's life chances going forward, you know, so they can go have their issues somewhere else and be brought back and have a chance at getting married and, you know, joining the community as an adult and with an unsullied reputation. I think there's a long tradition of that in Mormonism.
What's also interesting, too, of course, is these sort of hackneyed strategies that they have. The theories, you know, the strategies don't seem to have much, you know, actual sociological
science
behind them. And certainly in Alex's case, they were clumsy at best, the way they tried to sort of scare her straight is probably the best way to put it. And, you know, they end up physically and psychologically, you know, abusing her, basically.
So, you know, we can start with what we do know, which thanks to the Family Acceptance Project out of San Francisco State University, you know, scientific study of mental health outcomes, emotional health like outcomes, life outcomes for LGBT youth. We know that even religious families who have theological reservations, if they're able to be accepting of their children, if they're able to connect their children with resources, including resources to support and promote their mental health and sexual health practices, sexually healthy, you know, practices, the outcomes are much better in terms of academic attainment, mental health and well-being, avoidance of drug use or substance abuse. So we know what works. What goes on, as you said, in the residential treatment centers and then in sort of the home style version Alex was exposed to in an unlicensed treatment therapy, which is really in a residential home, is this, again, this notion of you remove the child from the family context, you break them down and try and remake them. And in Alex's case, the process of breaking down, her personal possessions were taken away. Her regular clothing was taken away. She was provided instead a wardrobe of thrift store cast-offs, you know, kind of church camp T-shirts and long skirts. She was programmed into a regimen of doing housework and group scripture study and prayer. And the group scripture study was sometimes kind of morph into a group therapy where everyone would relay or be challenged on or confronted with their shortcomings and asked to take ownership for them. And when this sort of daily regimen didn't seem to be breaking her will enough, it was escalated. And so physical elements were added. Alex was forced to wear a backpack with rocks in it around the house during the day as she did her chores, as she went to group, until she went to bed at night. And when that didn't work, it was even escalated further, and she was made to stand and face a wall for hours on end in one place, not allowed to move, wearing the backpack.
We're going to come back to that because there's a kind of I think chilling is the word that you and Alex use in the book, moment when people would come in and out of the house seeing her standing facing a wall and not really say much about it. And I think there's an interesting cultural element in that story. But I want to back up just a bit and sort of get into the story of Alex. So she grows up Give us a sense of who she is. She has this dream of becoming a lawyer and living in New York City. You know, the typical kinds of kid fantasies, which are really interesting. And there seemed to be this kind of subconscious testing that she's doing, riding a go-kart too fast, for example. And she says in the book, she knows that she was testing her parents because she wanted to know if they really loved her. And I'm guessing there's some subconscious stuff going on here, knowing that she has a sense that she's different and in some ways anticipating how she's going to deal with that, I guess.
Certainly, from the beginning, Alex was the youngest child in a large Mormon family. It was a second marriage for her mother. Her father was and is a convert. Yeah. And so, you know, from the beginning, Alex was a little bit of an outlier in the family, being the child of the second marriage, but also was just born spunky.
Yeah.
Was always the kid, you know, painting her Pioneer handcart at family home evening, you know, purple with sparkles on it. And, you know, really, she characterizes herself that way for me. And it's really true to who she is. Alex definitely has a mind of her own and is a free spirit. It's one of the things I love about this story. But, you know, another thing that really struck me about Alex's story is from the beginning, you know, even as a free spirit, she listened in church on Sundays. Mm. And at a very young age, probably when she was only about, you know, 10 years old, and, you know, she talks about this in the book, she realized in Sunday school that there was a crack in Mormon theology that she fell through. I mean, she'd been raised in this embrace of this notion families are forever, and if we follow the commandments, we'll all be safe and held together. But her parents had not been sealed for eternity, had not been married in a Mormon temple for eternity, because her mother's first marriage was a temple marriage for eternity, and policy at that time prohibited it.
Yeah.
So Alex realizes when she's 10 that she's effectively sealed to no one for the eternities as the child of the second marriage. And this truly impacted her. Raised in this context where families are willing to do so much for the promise of eternal togetherness, where communities, and this is another theme of the book, communities are willing to sacrifice so much, even essential parts of themselves and their children, for the promise of being safe and together, the plan offered her no guarantee. And that crack in Mormon theology introduced into Alex as well a critical consciousness. So anyone who underestimates the impact of, you know, quietly persisting theological problems in Mormonism also underestimates how smart Mormon kids are, how seriously they take what they're taught in Sunday school, and how the flaws in our theology are seen.
It's interesting, her sense of faith throughout this experience. She says from time to time, And in some cases, the darkest moments, she mentions praying like a Mormon girl. I prayed like the girl I still was, gay or not, and always had been. You know, prayed like a Mormon girl, her sense of faith. What part did that play in the way she was working through all of this?
You know, this is something I talk about in an article I wrote for Religion Dispatches about the book. Again, one of the things, you know, what contributed to Alex's resilience? You know, we hear a lot of stories, unfortunately, in LDS communities about young LGBT people who harm themselves, who even take their own lives. These are devastating stories. There are also tremendous stories of people who stay resilient, even stay gay and Mormon at the same time, and live happy, healthy lives. And, you know, one of the things that contributed to Alex's resilience was her understanding of theology and her critical perspective on it that came from her own sort of falling through the cracks in terms of her parents not being sealed for eternity in the temple. So when she was being held at the residential treatment center and her captors were trying to push what they characterize as Mormon theology on her, you know, God has no place for you. She was able to recognize as extreme or as incorrect some elements of the way they were representing Mormon theology. And it gave her a critical distance and allowed her to maintain internally her own reservoir of faith practices. And yeah, she prayed when she was facing the wall with the rocks in the backpack for hours on end. She prayed when she was in pain. She told me, you know, remembering specific stories from the Book of Mormon, from the Book of Enos about, you know, the prophet going into the woods to pray and pray and pray and pray and pray. And she remembers this when she's at the wall. I think it's just such a robust example of how Mormonism can provide, you know, resources on the margins, even resources for resilience, health, even in adverse circumstances, and can be used as an instrument of terrible abuse.
The one of the men, the sort of father of the house in this residential, so-called residential treatment center, as you say, he mentions to her that that the plan of salvation doesn't apply to gay people. And this is one of the sort of weirdest theories in the book. He tells Alex that her parents are good people, that they're going to get into the Mormon celestial kingdom. And then he says this, he says, and God won't want to deprive them. So there will be a copy of you with them, but right. It won't really be you. Now, she knows enough to think that's nonsense, but what is that about?
I love the story of Alex being in that house and basically running Sunday school back at her captors in her head and saying, you failed. That's not anywhere in our theology. How close attention do we pay when we are raised Mormon, when we're, you know, brought up in this theology, to where we're going to be in the eternities with our family? So, you know, we are a people who know our theology. Even children know our theology because it's so desperately important to our sense of identity. And so here's Alex, even being, you know, a kid who acted out, even being headstrong, even being spunky, was willing to push back on this very weird, you know, sort of distorted misrepresentation of Mormon theology and take strength in it.
Joanna Brooks is with us. The book that she co-authored with Alex Hooper is Saving Alex. And here's the subtitle. It's super long. When I was 15, I told my Mormon parents I was gay, and that's when my nightmare began. We're talking about it with Joanna Brooks, who's joining us from a studio in La Mesa, California, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the sad and strange story of Alex Cooper. Alex was a young Mormon kid living in California. And when she was 15, she came out to her parents, who sent her here to Utah, to St. George, to a family, a couple who figured they could use the same kinds of tactics on Alex that they saw used on juvenile delinquents. It's a strange story. These people figured they could cure Alex or save her from a life of homosexuality. The scholar Joanna Brooks has helped Alex write her story. The book is called Saving Alex, and she's joining us today to talk about it. There are a couple of moments in this story that I wanted to ask you about. One of them is when she finally, as I mentioned there in that introduction, mentions it to her family. They don't take it well. They kick her out at first, and then she ends up in staying with the bishop of their ward, the Flores family. She writes in the book that the Flores family didn't say anything. They didn't scold or they didn't preach, but they also didn't reassure. And it seems like this is kind of a theme in this story, this kind of reluctance of people to say anything. There are a couple of moments I mentioned before. You know, you were talking about this moment when she is forced to, for hours on end, stare at a wall. And the Mormon missionaries come over from time to time to have dinner with this family. And they see her standing there and no one really says anything. So what do you think is going on there?
Oh, it's one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the book for me. And, you know, Alex was made invisible. As a gay person, she was expected to closet herself, of course, or to expunge that part of herself. But even as a human, when she was in this sort of treatment setting, no one would see her pain. And there is a scene where she is facing the wall, you know, mm-hmm. and I mean, neighbors are coming and going from the home where she's held. It's in a residential neighborhood. There are children in the home. There is the normal, you know, sort of traffic and flow. And the missionaries come over for dinner and no questions are asked
yeah.
because the people who held her had a reputation in the community as doing good work, knowing what they were doing. You know, no questions are asked. Even when she speaks to the bishop of the ward she's attending and says, you know, for her birthday interview, and says, look, I'm being this good, this bad things are happening to
yeah.
me. I'm being abused. The bishop again responds, you know, these are good people. They're just trying to help you. There's even a scene really early in the book. I mean, there's a number of scenes in the book where she tries to escape.
Yeah, yeah.
Where she even kind of cries out and runs and is beaten. These are in McDonald's in St. George mm-hmm. and Smith's and Albertsons. You know, and so I think one of the painful parts of the story is that it's a mirror on Mormon life. What are the things we refuse to see in each other?
Yeah.
Who are the people we make invisible in order to maintain our hold on a feeling of security and safety? And in writing this book, you know, it came home to me how much Mormonism is a theological revolt against death and loss. Mm-hmm. I think of Joseph Smith's vision of his brother Alvin and how motivated the early saints were. Historians have written about this so eloquently, how motivated the early saints were to, you know, pursue proxy ordinances for their dead relatives as a revolt against death. But in order to beat death, we give up on life. We give up on living people in our own families who don't fit the pattern, who can't stay within the mold. And we expend people like Alex, like LGBT people who want to live to the fullest measure of their creation. We expend women of color from having full voice, full visibility, full authority in our community. So, I mean, so really it's a very dramatic scene to think of Alex standing there against the wall being invisible. But she turns it back in the book as we were talking about it. You know, she said, look, I knew I was going to get out of the residential treatment center someday, but those young men could very well stay in a culture for their whole lives where they were facing a wall, not able to see the bigger world around them, not even able to see people like me.
Yeah. Can I read that part? Because I think
because
she really relates to these young missionaries, which is interesting. It shows how kind of mature her thinking is. I mean, she's like, here they are, these kids far away from home. They can't see their family or talk to them on the phone. You know, that's what missionaries you do. They're isolated. And then she says, as you said, she says, someday I will get out of this house. But would they, here's how you put it in the book, would they ever get back their ability to see things they weren't supposed to see, to ask questions they weren't supposed to ask, or would they be locked in for life?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, when I was interviewing some of the folks in St. George who helped with Alex's story, you know, one of them said to me very straight, you know, this is a community of secrets. And, you know, we know, you know, in Southern Utah, we LDS communities have lived cheek by jowl with fundamentalist LDS communities who are, you know, really cousins. And we have disowned entire parts of our own history and left communities, you know, on the margins to metastasize in their own way and lead to terrible, you know, isolation because we can't see our own history. We can't own it. You know, we're a culture of secrets is what one of Alex's confidants told me.
There's this question she asks, why didn't she just walk out the door? And it's interesting that question always comes up with people who are held captive. I'm thinking Elizabeth Smart, for example. The question always came up. What do you think is the way she deals with this? And because this sort of gets us to this point, you mentioned it earlier, and I wanted to spend a little bit more time with it. This idea that LGBT kids end up in state custody far more frequently than straight kids. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, Alex does escape, and she does enter the legal system sort of as a ward of the state. Her custody status is uncertain for a while. At the same time, she's labeled by the people who are supposed to be her advocates as, quote, ungovernable.
Yeah.
9 out of 10, you know, studies show, research shows that 9 out of 10 of the LGBT kids in the legal system have at some point been labeled ungovernable. It's fascinating and heartbreaking to think about how kids who come from non-accepting homes are then labeled with legal terms. You know, kids who refuse to follow their family of origins, teachings or doctrines about homosexuality then become, you know, criminalized in a way and enter the legal system. 13 to 15% of young people in the system are LGBT, which is, you know, depending on what figures you go by, probably double the representation in the population overall. 20 to 40% of homeless youth are LGBT. So, you know, being an LGBT young person significantly increases one's vulnerability, the vulnerability of one's personhood, safety, economic security, and makes it much more likely to end up in the legal system or even homeless.
You also say this in the book, that of the thousands of teenagers who will sleep on the streets or under bridges in Utah tonight, fully half of them are LGBT kids, and the majority are from Mormon families. And I wanted to ask you about that. You say that most experts who talk to LGBT kids in juvenile justice say this, say families hold the key. Would you talk about that, this family element? Because this is seems like this is a theme too.
Absolutely. And I want to just acknowledge the work of people like Marion Edmonds Allen in working in Utah out of Ogden with vulnerable LGBT young people, and of Caitlin Ryan at the Family Acceptance Project at San Francisco State University, you know, both of whom are leaders on the ground and in research on better outcomes. And, you know, what's so damaging about the methods applied to Alex is that she was forcibly removed from a family context, mm-hmm. or forcibly pushed out of an originary family context, that right at the moment she most needed to feel those ties pull her back in and say, we've got you, you're not going anywhere, we're going to sit together and work this out across our differences, which is actually the very hopeful place the book ends up. You know, in the critical moment when she's so vulnerable, she is ripped from the context of her family. And it's that critical moment when a child comes out. Does the family draw the child in, even across theological disagreement, fear, anxiety, disappointment, depression? Does a family hold closer, or is the child sort of, you know, detached or released from family bonds? And it's being able to feel those family bonds through adolescence and into adulthood, and feel them in a good way, you know, as being resilient, as capable of absorbing difference and of growing over time, that, you know, is the key for kids like Alex. And when that's not the case, there's incredible vulnerability, economic, educational, health. You know, crimes of survival land most LGBT kids in the criminal justice system because of their vulnerability.
Alex writes this: the idea of home is the best thing we have, and sometimes it's the only thing. But once that bond is broken, that brokenness stays inside us. I think that's that idea of breaking that bond is again one of those themes that I sort of identified in this story, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, this idea of these conversion therapies. And they seem, in this story here, they kind of go underground. I guess that's a way to put it. And why do they persist? And I wonder if, Joanna Brooks, you sort of empathize with these Mormon parents who are confused about what they're supposed to do with this fact that their kid is, you know, is gay, and where does that fit in the scheme of things, and how can we cure them? Can we, you know, This idea of these conversion therapies, where does that fit still, you know, in the 21st century?
I don't think things are getting better for LGBT people and their families in Mormonism. And I, my hope was that Alex and I could release this book at a time when we could say, wow, this is so long ago. Yeah. It just happened in 2010. That's when Boyd K. Packer made his, you know, very, very regrettable speech at General Conference. that's in the past. That's the days of Prop 8 and we're in a new place now. But, you know, the context is not that. Just, you know, as Mormon people know, just in the last 6 months since November, when a new policy was announced by the church indicating that or preventing the children of married LGBT couples from having a name and a blessing, having their names on the records of the church, and then being baptized at the traditional age of 8, having to wait until they were of basically legal maturity and then renouncing their parents' lifestyle, quote, unquote, lifestyle. And then also declaring married LGBT people apostates and setting the stage in some communities, not all, but some, for, you know, bishops to actually seek out LGBT couples who are sort of quietly persisting on the rolls and start to sort of initiate disciplinary contact. That's a minority, but that has happened. It's been heartbreaking. You know, that the new policy has produced real soul-searching across the orthodoxy spectrum in Mormonism, because it abruptly butts up against Jesus Christ's unequivocal welcome to children. It's in the New Testament. So all sorts of Mormon people across the orthodoxy spectrum have really been wrestling with, where did this come from? What is this about? So, you know, this has increased heartbreak, not ameliorated it. And this is the moment in which we are telling Alex's story. And I wish we could say it's getting better in Mormonism for LGBT people. Alex certainly does not feel that way. Yeah. She's sort of on hiatus from all religion, I certainly can sympathize with. But at the same time, I can sympathize with, as you said, Doug, these families who are in an impossible position, parents of, you know, LGBT children who want to look forward to continuity in their generations, who want to see the grandchildren back at church, with parents, LGBT parents even, who want the same thing too, even though they may not attend. They want their kids to be a part of the family. And, you know, Mormonism is a family faith. And those people, faithful, good people, are cut off from the blessings of participation in full participation in Mormon life.
Joanna Brooks is with us. The book that she co-wrote with Alex Cooper is Saving Alex. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Joanna Brooks. We're talking about the book she co-wrote with Alex Cooper, Saving Alex. The subtitle gives you a sense of what it's about. When I was 15, I told my Mormon parents I was gay, and that's when my nightmare began. Joanna Brooks is joining us from a studio in La Mesa, California. I wanted to ask you, the legal component of this story is really fascinating. Let's set this up. She escapes, essentially. I guess that's the right word. I mean, yeah, there's not a better word.
She runs. Yeah, in the middle of the night, right?
Literally. And she is able to escape, and she's able to find, and we should talk about this, a network of, she mobilizes this whole network of people who start working to help her get out, and once she is out, helping her sort of situate herself. Would you talk about that network? That one of the people that she meets is a young man named Jason, and the role of these gay straight alliances in schools, the sort of crucial role that they play for young people like this, is another really important aspect of the story.
Absolutely. In the piece I wrote for Religion Dispatches, you know, in addition to having a critical perspective on urban theology, another of the great contributors to Alex's survival and resilience as an LGBT young person was that she had access to a gay-straight alliance. For a short period of the time she was held, she was allowed to attend the local high school and then removed from the high school again. But while she was there, she connected with Jason Osmanski, who is a great hero in the LGBT civil rights movement in southern Utah, although being a very young man. And it was Brave Jason who started the Gay Straight Alliance at his high school in St. George, despite, you know, being bullied, being ridiculed, and having the other sort of legal and policy constraints placed on the formation of the club that are, you know, that viewers might know are a part of the Utah context. There's been tremendous opposition to high school-based GSAs in Utah that's now gratefully mostly overcome. But the GSA was a critical spot. So when Alex ran again, she knew where to find Jason, and Jason could connect her to a legal team in Salt Lake City. Another of the great heroes of the story is an attorney named Paul Burke, mm-hmm. who is a quiet hero of the LGBT civil rights movement in Utah. And Paul pledged to be Alex's advocate through the process pro bono. And he stood by her and has and still stands with her to this day.
His role in the story is interesting. Just the personal element here. He takes her case, and it's really personal for him. And it's interesting also that he works for this firm that has some fairly conservative senior partners. So he's not sure what kind of resistance he's going to get. In the end, they support him, of course. But just talk about his role, because you also mentioned in the book that Paul seemed to make everyone nervous. I mean, he was the only non-Mormon person involved in mm-hmm. the case in some ways going on in St. George, where everyone seemed to be Mormon. And there was this idea, and this is another one of these sort of underlying concepts, that people were suspicious of him because they figured that these LGBT groups are trying to, you know, manipulate Alex as part of some, you know, gay plot or something.
Well, and this is really, I think, one of the most important parts of Alex's story. When Alex entered the legal system and there was a question about her custody, she was provided a court-appointed guardian ad litem. And, you know, the legal philosophy for representing vulnerable young people is that the legal advocate needs to act in, quote, the best interests of the child.
Right. So
Alex had a guardian ad litem appointed by the court who felt it was in Alex's best interest to be declared ungovernable and sent back home to her parents and, you know, without any sort of redress for the abuse she had suffered, without any sort of recognition that it was tantamount to torture, that it was based on her sexuality. No recognition of that at all. Just here's another troubled teen who needs to be sent back to her parents. Alex insisted on retaining Paul as independent counsel as well. And Paul, as soon as he heard Alex's story, reached out to a national network of LGBT civil rights advocates who said, you know, you've got to get her out of Utah. She's never going to be safe there. The policy of the state is to, you know, not intervene if parents try to manipulate or reorganize the sexual identity of the child. And that's true. That was, at the time, the policy and practice of the Attorney General's office.
Right. And
they said, put her on the next bus, you know. And so in the view of these sort of civil rights advocates, the best interest of the child was to get her immediately out of Mormonism, out of Utah, and away from her family. So that she could live a full life as a gay person.
Yeah.
And in the middle, Paul takes this radical middle path and he says to Alex, what do you want?
Right.
You know, the court wants to send you home to be totally Mormon with your family and safe and fit in the box. The LGBT civil rights folks want to get you totally out of Mormonism, get you totally safe so you could be a totally, you know, authentic gay person. What do you want? She said, I want both. She said, I want to go home. I'm 17. You know, I'm still young. I want to finish high school and live with my parents. But I want to date girls. Those are her words. I want to go home, but right. I want to date girls.
And I don't want my parents to try and change me.
Right. I don't want that. I love my parents. And, you know, the love between them is remarkable and persists. Families are forever is a part of Mormonism that does not wash off, you know.
Yeah.
And Paul stood by her and he said, okay, that's what we're going to do. We want you to go home. We want you to go home you know, with protection to live safely as a gay teenager and have growing up experiences in the shelter of your family as a gay young person. And a remarkable, you know, there's a wonderful family court judge, you know, in St. George who unfortunately is deceased. Her name is Carla Staley. And she stood up for it. She saw this vision and helped realize it through the custody order. She wrote, returning Alex to her parents, but writing in that Alex has to be allowed to date girls. So, yeah. You know, this wonderful scene where Alex goes to the high school prom, you know, goes to homecoming in her St. George High School with a girlfriend who is a bishop's daughter.
Right.
I mean, so it's, you know, she wanted both and she ended up achieving that, which is a remarkable legal victory, obtaining, you know, the right to live under the laws of the state of Utah as an openly gay teenager.
Is that still untested as a legal sort of precedent? Because it seems incredibly significant for an order like this to be imposed by, you know, by a court to say, look, you have to accept who she is. Because that big question, what are the legal rights of minors? That's a big question here too.
Absolutely. And there is a thick month's worth of correspondence between the various legal principals in Alex's case about Paul's right to represent her. And, you know, the state of Utah, the Attorney General's office did hold that Alex did not have the right as a minor to retain her own counsel, which would have left her to be represented, to have her best interest defined by a very conservative guardian ad litem in southern Utah who could not see her as a gay young person, who could only see her as a troubled young person. So, yes, this was a major issue of contention, Alex's right to retain her own independent counsel. And in scene after scene, you know, various, you know, Paul is being sort of elbowed out of the courtroom.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's coming in by speakerphone by Salt Lake saying, no, I'm in. Alex's voice, I'm in. So, you know, that was one victory, and that it then led to a pushback on the state's practice of allowing parents to intervene in the sexual identity of their children, at least, you know, when it came to sort of when those issues came to court. You know, as you said, there's a lot that still remains ongoing underground in Mormon communities. Mm-hmm. Parents, you know, look at their children and hope that they'll change all the time.
Yeah.
But at least on the legal record, Paul was actually able to back them into a corner and say, I have on, you know, he had a recording of a court hearing where the state attorney general's office was advocating that a parent should be able to change a child's identity. And he said, you know, is this really the policy of the state? Are you really prepared to stand by this? And you know, the state backed off.
Joanna Brooks, what can you say about Alex's relationship with her folks these days? She mentioned this when she's working this out, this summer of long silences and fierce unspoken battles when her parents were, you know, eventually they have to comply by the order of, you know, let her be what she is. But what's the relationship like now? And maybe you can say something about, I thought this was kind of an interesting twist that her father, who is a convert to Mormonism, she seemed unsure about what that exactly meant in terms of the way he was coping with all of this.
You know, Alex, from the beginning, has been very protective of her parents through this whole process. She fought hard to go home. And, you know, even through the difficult times they've been on skiing, she lives in Portland now, out of St. George. And, you know, they've been on Skype or on phone at least once, twice a week. She texts with her mom very frequently. So, you know, I'm very pleased to relay that at this point, Alex's parents are fully, you know, still very observant. LDS people are fully accepting of Alex, fully accepting of her and her girlfriend. Alex and her girlfriend Skype together with Alex's parents. They joke and tease them about, you know, hey, when you all going to get married and give us some grandkids?
Right.
So Alex is thrilled. I think her parents have been courageous and patient and forbearing in allowing this really difficult situation for their family to become a matter of public conversation. I hope that good comes of their willingness to allow this to be discussed so openly, because they're not the only LDS family that finds themselves forced with a choice between their faith and their child. And it's not a choice any family, any parents should have to make.
She tells about when she first escapes, and she's going through this process. You know, she's being processed through the state, and she's identifying who it is that's Mormon. Like, I wonder if she's Mormon, because that's not a good thing, and at least initially for her, like, because this is not going to help me. And she comes across this woman named Sandra, who is Mormon, and she's suspicious of it first. But Sandra tells her this thing. She says, I just want you to know that not all Mormons are like this. Right. And Alex talks about how this was the first moment someone had spoken up as a member of her religion to say that they were on her side and that God loved her for who she was. And that meant, it seems like that meant an awful lot to her.
You know, Alex's story is full of quiet local heroes, and many of them are LDS people. And that is part of the story we both really wanted to tell, that there is, you know, whatever the policies are coming out of Salt Lake, there is tremendous goodness among Mormon people in Mormon families. Sorry, makes me emotional. We are capable of looking out for each other. And so Alex is in the crisis center in St. George, and she's scanning everyone around her. Who knows the people I was held by? Who may send me back? And a woman named Sandra takes her out to Hurricane, you know, to see some horses grazing in a field, some baby foals grazing in a field in spring. And, you know, gives her this moment in the sun and says to her, look, I don't think that God thinks it's wrong that you're gay, and confides in her in this space outside of the church, outside of the institution, that there is a larger God. And, you know, the Mormon people I know have this capacity for seeing that larger God. And I think it's the saving grace of the story.
Joanna Brooks. She's a scholar of American culture and religion, associate vice president of faculty advancement, and a professor of English at San Diego State University. She co-authored, along with Alex Cooper, the book Saving Alex, joined us from a studio in La Mesa, California. Joanna, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.